Good morning. Elizabeth McClintock, attorney registration number 25990, appearing for the defendant appellant, Stephanie Deverick. May it please the court and counsel. Ms. Deverick, this is the direct appeal of her conviction for first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, accessory to commit murder, and misdemeanor child abuse. We've addressed three issues to the court on appeal. The first issue that I would like to review with the court is the abuse of discretion by the trial court for failing to grant a mistrial after a videotaped statement of Ms. Deverick was played to the jury without having been redacted, and in which the detective, when he is questioning Ms. Deverick, goes into a conversation with her about whether or not she would like to take a lie detector test.
Ms. McClintock,
yes.
Pardon me for interrupting you. My understanding of the record is that the videotape was available to both defense counsel and to the prosecutor in advance of its being played in court. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And no objection was lodged by defense counsel to any portion of the tape, nor was an objection lodged at the time the tape was actually played.
I believe it was lodged immediately after it was played, Your Honor. I understand that they did not stop the video at that point. My understanding was there was about 5 to 10 minutes, I think the trial court found, played after that portion. And yes, I think defense counsel at trial acknowledged that that was probably a tactical decision of not getting up in the middle of the videotape and objecting at that time, because she did not want to emphasize that evidence. And yes, I would acknowledge on appeal that that video was made available to her. However, as she indicates in the record, she was told that the prosecution was not going to be using that tape until immediately before the trial began. And I would point out to the court, it's really no excuse. I think defense counsel acknowledges that perhaps there is an issue of ineffective assistance there, that she did not raise it prior to trial. However, this was an extensive case. We dealt with several witnesses, or she did, excuse me, I wasn't the trial counsel, but she dealt with several witnesses. It was involving DNA evidence. It was a situation where Ms. Deverick actually did not commit the murder, as I think everyone would acknowledge, but her actions were what brought her into the situation and being convicted as a complicit.
And from the jury's perspective, all they saw in the tape was a brief exchange where the detective says, look, I'm not committing to anything here, hypothetically. If we were to offer you a polygraph, would you be willing to take it? And the defendant's response is, sure. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a bit about how that prejudices the defendant here?
In my opinion, Your Honor, and what I'm asking the court to do here is to establish, go beyond Munoz, and not just say it's per se inadmissible to show a consciousness of innocence, but it is just per se inadmissible to keep talking about polygraph examinations.
To recognize that in Munoz, as I recall,
right,
the ruling was, we're not going to allow a self-effacing statement by the defendant to be admitted, clearly for the purposes of exonerating the defendant.
Right. Yeah, in an attempt to do that.
So, I mean, this is the other side of that coin.
Right. And the reason why I'm asking the court to go beyond Munoz and do that is because if we look in popular culture today, and that is where our jurors come from, is popular culture. Every time you see a child missing, every time there is a murder, not every time, but every time it makes national news, such as the Florida case, currently before us with the neighborhood watch captain, there's constant mention in the news as to whether or not that person who is a suspect has taken a polygraph examination or has refused to take one, or if they passed one. People are curious about this, and it comes into the public opinion, whereas if someone does not take one of these, that it shows an indication of guilt. Now, we in the legal profession know that these tests are inherently unreliable. That is why they are not admissible in a courtroom. But yet, we have jurors that come in, and they have heard so many times. There's popular TV shows that are out there that put people under lie detector examinations to determine whether or not paternity. It is part of the popular culture. And we, as a legal system, need to say, this might be acceptable in the courtroom of public opinion, but is not acceptable in a court of law. We need to quit talking about polygraph examinations in court. They are not reliable. The jurors in this situation see Ms. Devrick saying, sure, I'll do it, I'll take it. And then what question does that then raise in their mind? Oh, we didn't hear anything about what happened with that. And she said she didn't know anything that about this murder was going to happen. She thought Ms. Mawson was going to go in and rough up Ms. Young, and that was the extent of it. And her credibility on that issue was her central defense here. So when they hear about this polygraph examination being offered to her and her saying, sure, I'll take it, in their minds, it raises the specter, she probably took it and she probably failed it. I think that is a reasonable inference.
Also, she gave a second statement, did she not?
Yes, she did.
Was that played for the jury?
No, I don't believe that it was. Yes, it was just the first, if I recall. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't particularly recall, but my understanding was that it was not. No. That is why I'm urging this court to go beyond Munoz. We would not have to have this discussion again in a case if we just said, in this case, no more. Polygraphs are not reliable. They're not admissible. Do not talk about them. If you have detectives questioning a suspect on a videotape talking about a polygraph examination, prosecutors take proactive steps and redact that tape. Yes.
You're asking us to adopt a blanket rule that any mention of a polygraph leads to reversal. Is that correct?
Yes. I would say if this court were to adopt a bright line rule that says mentions of polygraphs are not acceptable, they should not be done. Yes, I suppose in the future from this point forward, yes, that it would be reversible error. And I would point to it is statutory and not case law, but we have in DUI cases, portable breath tests. Those don't get mentioned. They're administered almost all the time to suspects in DUI cases. The statute says don't talk about them in court. They're not admissible. That is what our state statute says. So they are not mentioned. And we do not have, there is not case law talking about reversible cases because portable breath tests were administered and talked about in court because people know we're not going to talk about them here. That is what I'm requesting this court to do in regards to polygraphs as well.
Because the popular culture has educated or miseducated jurors, you urge us to, in effect, reverse several cases that have been on the books for a number of years.
I don't think those would reverse those convictions that have been on the books for several years. But I think that, yes, if going forward, if we say, not just because of popular culture, but because of the fact that in a court of law, these tests are not admissible.
Since there's absolutely no evidence of popular culture in the record, I'm assuming that we're to take judicial notice of that.
I would ask you to take judicial notice of it, yes, Your Honor, and it is just argument. I don't have support in the popular record for it. However, I think the court can do that.
Well, if we're going to do that, I mean, don't we have to take notice of the fact that the FBI and other law enforcement agencies use polygraphs extensively for their own personnel when they're seeking to hire somebody, for example? I mean, there must be, the problem with taking notice of popular culture is that it's all over the map, isn't it?
I suppose that's true, yes. The difference is that when they are using those tests, it is not to, it's not in a court of law.
Suppose we'd also have to take judicial notice of the use of polygraphs by corporations to screen employment applications.
No, I don't believe that you would, actually, because, again, those are not in a court of law. If you wanted to look at their reliability for that, I guess then we go back to the entire situation of whether or not they're reliable and should be admitted in court. And case after case says that they are not. The other issue I'd like to address briefly with the court is the mens rea element in the child abuse instruction. I think the state has conceded that the written instruction that was provided to the jury was incorrect, and that the prosecutor in her first closing argument, there were two separate prosecutors, the original prosecutor in her closing argument reiterated the error by stating that jurors could either find Ms. Devereck left the child knowingly or recklessly in danger of injury, or that left the child in a situation that posed a risk of injury. I think there's a reasonable probability that that error was plain error. The jurors took that erroneous instruction back there with them. It was clear that one of the prosecutors herself did not understand the instruction and reiterated the incorrect standard to the jury. And I believe that that was error, and it did contribute to Ms. Devereck's conviction on child abuse. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I'd like to begin by just making it clear that both of the defendant's videotaped interviews were admitted at trial. The first interview took place on April 18th, and that was admitted as Exhibit 41. And that's about a 2.5 hour interview, and about 10 minutes from the end of it, there is the mention of the polygraph exam. The second interview took place on April 19th, the following day. That was the one where, after about an hour and a half, the defendant confessed to her role in the crime. That was admitted at trial as Exhibit 39, and that was admitted at page 134 of the transcript of the jury trial on August 13th, 2008.
So given that admission, I suppose the argument would be that the mention of a polygraph is totally harmless because the jury had before them the defendant's change of heart and change of statements in which she inculpated herself, essentially.
Well, why I think it's harmless is because there's no mention of a test actually being taken, let alone what the results are, which I think are what is most damaging about the admission of reference to a polygraph exam. Because a polygraph exam, if a witness is known to have passed it, that unfairly bolsters that witness's testimony. Whereas if a witness is known to have failed a polygraph, that unfairly impeaches the witness's testimony. But I think when we look at the record here, we can draw an inference from the fact that there's this subsequent interview that no polygraph was taken because there's no mention of it in the subsequent interview. And it clearly is not what caused the defendant to confess, because the fact finder, the jury, saw both the first interview and the hour and a half of the second interview before the defendant chose to confess. We also, in this case, of course, have a third statement by the defendant, which was her testimony in the defense case. So the jury had all of these means to evaluate the defendant's credibility with regard to her statements. But I think, turning back to the question of polygraph, I mean, it's clearly a tool used by police in the investigative process. It's also a tool used often post-conviction in probation or parole situations. So, you know, obviously there is a role for polygraph, but it is considered absolutely inadmissible at trial. I don't think we need a new rule saying that it's absolutely inadmissible at trial. I think our case law clearly says that. The question is whether a mention of it is per se a reversible error, and our cases do not say so. After all, a defendant is not entitled to a perfect trial. The defendant is entitled to a fair trial. And courts have consistently held that a passing mention of a polygraph does not constitute a reversible error, and a trial court does not abuse its discretion in saying that this does not warrant the drastic remedy of mistrial.
Troy Braun, am I misunderstanding your brief if I take it to be a confession, essentially, that the child abuse instruction was in error?
Well, what bothers me about the child abuse instruction, and I think what bothers all of us, is that the mental state has not been offset. I think the one thing that possibly saves this instruction from being error is the comma placement, because the third element reads knowingly, comma, or recklessly caused injury, or comma. So I think it could be read that the recklessly would only modify the caused injury, and the knowingly before that phrase set off by commas would then modify the permitted a child to be unreasonably placed. So I think that this court could find that under the circumstances it didn't constitute error. On the other hand, as I said, I am bothered by the fact that generally we apply the offset rule where the culpable mental state is offset. And here it's not offset because the caused injury or phrase is included with the culpable mental states. I think whoever drafted this instruction perhaps intended just to admit the caused injury or language, because it was conceded by the prosecution that no injury was caused to the child here. In looking at a plain error standard of review, and it's interesting here that the trial court asked counsel to carefully look at the jury instructions. He said he would give a special prize to whoever found the most errors in the jury instructions so that they could be corrected before going to the jury. So obviously, the court and counsel did look over the instructions. No one noticed this. It went to the jury. But the question is whether it constitutes plain error requiring reversal because it rendered the trial fundamentally unfair. And there are two reasons why this court can find that it's not plain error. The first is that it's essentially has not been disputed by the defense. The prosecutor urged the court in rebuttal closing to find that the defendant knowingly permitted the child to be unreasonably placed in a situation that posed a threat of injury to the child's life or health. So she read the instruction, as I noted, without the phrase set off by the commas, and asked the jury to find that the victim, that the defendant did this knowingly. And I think, as I said, that the defense did not dispute this. There's also absolutely overwhelming evidence that she did knowingly permit this child to be unreasonably placed in a situation that that posed a threat of injury to the child's life or health. In her own testimony, she acknowledged that she knew the child was in this motel room. She had played with the child in the motel room earlier that day. She knew the child was on the bed when she and the co-defendant went in there and when the co-defendant slit the victim's throat. She knew the child was there. She then left the child with the dying mother. So I think clearly that there's overwhelming evidence of her guilt, and that the error, if any, in this jury instruction did not constitute plain error requiring reversal.
Do you have any other questions for you, counsel?
Well, I thank this court for its time and attention. I'd ask you to affirm the judgment of conviction.
I just have a brief rebuttal. I stand corrected, yes. There were two statements. Obviously, they were both played. I would concede that point. In regards to the knowingly element, I would point out that it was only in rebuttal that the second prosecutor corrected what should have been the right instruction to the jury. I would concede defense counsel did not talk about the child abuse charge in her closing arguments. Frankly, it was probably the least of her considerations. It was a Class 2 misdemeanor offense, and she needed to focus on a first-degree murder and a conspiracy, and as she was arguing, an accessory, which should have been what she believed Ms. Devrick was guilty of. And that was her argument. She did not address the child abuse charge. I am in agreement with that. I am also in agreement that we are stuck with the plain error standard of review because of the fact that it was not objected to at the trial. However, I would dispute that there was ample evidence showing that Ms. Devrick knowingly knew that that child was now put in a situation of being in danger after they left. And because the argument was is that the child was basically left alone with his dying mother. Ms. Devrick had no blood on her. She testified that she had turned away when Ms. Mawson was assaulting Ms. Young. She testified, and the evidence seemed to support it, that she did not see the cut to Ms. Young that caused her death. She did not see the blood. And the last thing that she heard as she was leaving was Ms. Young speaking at that time, saying, "What did you do?" And she was saying that to Ms. Mawson. So at the time that she left that motel room, she believed Ms. Young was fine, that she had been assaulted by Ms. Mawson. And it wasn't until she got to the car and saw Ms. Mawson and saw what happened and heard Ms. Mawson's statements that she knew that something else than what she testified to was going to happen, happened in that motel room. So she did not know until after she had left that Ms. Young was could possibly be dead. When she left that room, Ms. Young was still speaking. So I think the evidence could be interpreted that she did not knowingly place that child in jeopardy. Does the court have any other questions? Thank you. Ms. Devrick would ask that her convictions be reversed. Thank you.
Both for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.